Good day. Today is Friday, 6th March 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched and listened to this programme, or whichever part of this programme you want to watch and listen to, you decide that you've liked what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Well, today, 6th March 2026, we are entering, as I understand it, the sixth day of the conflict between the United States and Israel and Iran. And it may be that I am misreading the signals, but I'm beginning to sense that in the United States and perhaps in Israel itself, though I'm not as familiar with the mood in Israel, but certainly in the United States, the doubts about the direction of the conflict are growing and expectations are becoming more pessimistic. Now, let's begin with a quick overview of the military situation. First of all, the United States continue to launch air attacks against Iran. Now, yesterday I discussed reports that an F-15 fighter jet had been lost over southwest Iran. This was then confirmed by an American agency, OSINT, which, as I understand, is very supportive and close to the US military. It's independent of the US military, but it's very supportive of them. It generally supports this military campaign. They said that they'd obtained information about this incident, that the F-15 had probably been shot down by Iranian air defences, that the pilot and the navigator landed safely, they parachuted safely to the surface, and that the US military were able to rescue both of these two people, and that they were taken to a hospital in Saudi Arabia and were receiving treatment there for their slight injuries. In other words, a fairly detailed discussion of the incident. And then a short time later, the US military officially denied that an F-15 had been lost. And, well, there was an interesting response to this from OSIN. They said that they would delete all their previous reports about this incident, but they still trusted and believed the information provided by their sources. Now, to me, that looks like them saying that they think that what the US military are saying about this particular episode is false, that the US military, the Pentagon, in other words, is lying. Now, I may be reading more into these comments by OSINT than they intended, but that seems to me the obvious and logical explanation, interpretation of their words. And of course, if this is true, if we are starting to see evidence that the US military is lying about the progress of the military campaign, then of course that may have wider implications about the information we're getting from them altogether. Anyway, that's one thing. But the other thing is that there's also been some further reports that the B-52 bombers that were conducting strikes against Iran, there's no doubt that they have been brought into the operation. We've seen pictures of them taking off from American airfields. I'd assume that these very powerful but very old bombers, dating from the 1950s, were being used to drop gravity bombs on targets in Iran. But anyway, it appears that that might not be the case, that they are continuing to launch strikes against Iran. using long-range missiles, JASSMs missiles to be precise. And this, it seems, is true of other American bombers as well. In other words, the United States is still not conducting regular operations over Iranian territory. From time to time, American and Israeli aircraft do appear to operate above Iran, but this is on a relatively small scale, and it looks as if claims that the United States has achieved complete air control of Iran's skies are untrue. For the record, there's also been an article in one of that in extraordinary galaxy of American military publications that in effect says the same thing, that claims that the United States has achieved complete aerial dominance of the skies over Iran are exaggerated and premature. As to that, I would repeat the point that I made in my program yesterday. The sheer size of Iran, a country twice as big as Ukraine, which is itself the second biggest country in Europe, or which was the second biggest country in Europe before the war there began. The enormously complex terrain, the high mountains, the large forested areas, the cities, the spread out cities, all of that make it all but inconceivable, as far as I can see, for the United States to achieve the kind of aerial dominance over Iran that it certainly did achieve over Iraq in the 1990s. So these reports, these claims, are overstated, and it appears that they are wrong. Now, the Iranians, for their part, continue to conduct strikes against Israel and against American targets across the Middle East. And they have recently been exhibiting use of their more advanced, more powerful ballistic missiles, clearly despite claims that Iran is short of ballistic missiles and of drones. They continue to conduct strikes against American and Israeli targets across the Middle East. And there has now been a clear picture emerging. There are now lots of apparently unchallengeable photo pictures of this, which show that Iran has been, over the first few days of this operation, that Iran has been conducting a systematic and apparently largely successful campaign to destroy American radar systems across the entirety of the Middle East. Now, I am not in a position to count the number of radar systems that the Iranians have destroyed, but it does look as if a TAD radar system, for example, was indeed destroyed. It appears that that great radar complex in Qatar was destroyed as well. A couple of days ago, there was an article in the Financial Times which suggested that the claims that this radar system in Qatar had been destroyed by the Iranians was based on AI manipulation of satellite pictures. I have no doubt that such AI manipulation does take place. But it seems now that there is an enormous accumulation of independent evidence that does indeed corroborate the destruction of this very important radar in Qatar. And, well, again, I am not going to discuss in this program the full implications of the destruction of these radars these American radars. But my sense is that, to the extent that I can understand, this is significantly going to impact not just the air defense situation on the part of the United States and Israel, the American ability to track Iranian missile launches and to guide air defense interceptors to intercept those missiles. But it's also going to affect the American ability to track what is taking place over the skies of Iran, the arrival, for example, of transport aircraft to perhaps some of the more northern Iranian air bases from Russia and China. Now, I say all of this, there's been a very interesting interview given to an American news channel by the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi. Now, along with saying that Iran not only does not fear a ground invasion by the United States and Israel, but on the contrary welcomes it, because that would provide a further opportunity for Iran to defeat that ground invasion, things of that kind, which one can perhaps write off as the sort of displays of bravado that one would expect from both sides during a conflict of this kind. I noticed that Araghchi appeared to confirm that Iran has indeed received significant assistance from China and Russia, that the Chinese and the Russians are continuing to provide help, though he was very careful not to say what that help was. And, well, he left the question open as to what that help might be. And this mirrors a recent comment by Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. He too was asked about Russian assistance to Iran. He again evaded giving any clear answer about this, or so it seemed to me. But he did say that the Russians and the Iranians are in constant communication with each other, which I did find interesting. And it seems that there are still significant numbers, hundreds in fact, of Russian personnel at the Bushehr nuclear power plant in northern Iran, which Russia, of course, partly built. And, well, it does seem as if the Russians have presence on the ground in Iran as well. And, of course, the Chinese, for their part, continue to publish satellite photos of American bases across the Middle East, and by doing so, of course, provide free and public targeting information for the Iranians. I am not going to speculate about the assistance that the Russians and the Chinese might be giving to the Iranians. But I know that there is speculation, and it is only speculation, that the effectiveness of this Iranian campaign to destroy American radar bases across the Middle East is partly explained by assistance from China and Russia, that they have been providing the Iranians with the targeting information. And of course, there were those reports from Russia that I spoke about some weeks ago, about the Russians having provided assistance to Iran in improving the accuracy of their missiles and perhaps their drones as well, to make it more possible for the Iranians perhaps to conduct these attacks on the American radar systems. Now, again, let me stress, this is all very speculative. Araghchi did not say that the Russians and the Chinese are helping Iran conduct its military campaign or defend itself. His comments fell far short of that. Peskov's comments appear to fall far short of that too. Araghchi might have a reason to overstate the extent of Russian Chinese support for Iran at this time. He might want to convey the impression that Iran is not isolated, that Iran is not without friends, and he might, for that reason alone, want to suggest that the Chinese and the Russians are more supportive of Iran and more involved in the defense of Iran than they really are. But set against that, the fact that the Russians have repeatedly referred to the attack on Iran as an act of aggression, that the Russians have made very supportive comments of Iran altogether, that Putin himself, after the killing of Khamenei, wrote a letter to President Pezeshkian of Iran expressing condolences for Khamenei's death and referring to the attack on Khamenei as cynical and unlawful and in effect immoral as well. And that the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi has also, in conversations with Araghchi, as reported in the Chinese media, spoken of China's support for Iran in its struggle to defend its sovereignty. So if you put all of this together, and if you look at the effectiveness of these Iranian strikes on these radars, then, well, I'm going to say that this does look to me like the activation of what was clearly a long-term plan and also a plan which, because of its sophistication and because of the accuracy of these attacks, does seem to me, especially in the light of the comments from the Russians and the Chinese, to suggest some degree of external assistance from countries that are able to provide Iran with targeting intelligence, which perhaps Iran itself, for all the sophistications of its society and the size of its industrial base, probably is not able to obtain by itself. So this is interesting and it is suggestive, and the United States must of course be aware of the destruction of its radars, which does appear to be on a very extensive scale, and this must be causing, I am sure it is causing, significant concern in the Pentagon and amongst US officials. And of course we continue to receive, and now there are many, many reports about this, reports about shortages of standoff munitions, of air-to-air missiles, of cruise missiles, JASSMs and Tomahawk missiles, and of course, first and foremost, of air defence interceptors. Specifically, and I think this is perhaps the key thing to say, of Patriot and TAD air defence missile interceptors. Again, it's difficult to get a complete picture of what is happening here, but the Iranians continue to conduct missile strikes. We had all those optimistic comments by Hegseth and Kane 2 days ago about how Iran's missile arsenal had missile strikes had fallen by 80%, and Iran's drone strikes had reduced by 70%. I have to say that is not the feeling I am getting from the number of targets that Iran is engaging. No doubt there's an ebb and flow, and as I said, the Iranians anyway would have good reasons not to conduct strikes in quite the volumes that they did on the first 2 days. But anyway, put that aside, it does seem as if stresses on American inventories are growing, and that they continue to grow all the time, and that the hoped for expected moment when the US Air Forces can start to operate over Iran using gravity bombs, that those might be at least further away than some people in the Pentagon were hoping. Now, perhaps here I would just add one further thing. Up to now, from what I can see, virtually all of the attacks on Iran, at least the ongoing attacks on Iran, have been conducted by ground-based American aircraft. There's been an enormous amount said and discussed about this huge fleet that the United States gathered in the Arabian Sea. And of course, on the first few days, it does seem that these warships did indeed launch large numbers of Tomahawk missiles against Iran. But the Iranians have claimed that they did manage to conduct drone strikes on the USS Abraham Lincoln. There is absolutely no confirmation of this, incidentally, whatsoever, and the Iranians have provided no corroboration at all, no video footage of these alleged drone strikes. But the Iranians are saying that whereas on the first days of the operation, the Abraham Lincoln and its destroyer escorts was within 380 kilometers of the Iranian coastline. Supposedly, allegedly, after these attacks, the Lincoln and its escorts moved further away and are now perhaps 1,000 kilometers away, which basically puts them beyond Iran's reach. Now, I am myself very skeptical about the Iranian claim of successful drone attacks on the Lincoln. If such a thing had actually taken place, I am sure the Iranians would have provided some drone footage of it. But I do think it is likely that the Iranians have indeed moved warships further away from the Iranian coast. In fact, there are multiple reports of this. Now, that would suggest that the Aegis-class destroyers still have a mostly complete arsenal of air defense missiles. So these missile stockpiles probably have not been depleted. But of course, they have been pushed away from a situation where it looks as if they can participate very actively in the war. I am not, again, an expert on aircraft ranges and that kind of thing, but I understand that for the aircraft on the Lincoln, a distance of 1,000 kilometers from the Iranian coast would put them not without beyond range, but it would make it more difficult for these aircraft, much more difficult for these aircraft to participate in air operations over Iran. So just saying, again, take all of this with a heavy grain of salt. I'm not there. This is to some extent beyond my areas of knowledge, just to say. But I have noticed that so far, most of the air attacks do against Iran are being conducted by ground-based aircraft, and this may explain why. Now, there are also reports that the other US carrier, the Gerald Ford, is now transiting through the Red Sea. It presumably is going to join the Lincoln in the Arabian Sea, or to be more precise, in the Indian Ocean. I don't know what the implications of that are, whether with a force of two carriers, the United States might feel that it is in a stronger position to engage Iran with its carrier forces. Of course, the destroyers will have the ability, the Ford's destroyers will have the ability to launch more Tomahawk missiles against Iran. But then, of course, that begs the question of what further strikes with these Tomahawk missiles are going to achieve. Anyway, we shall see. I'm also hearing stories, and I say, these are stories, they're not yet reports, that the Lincoln, which, sorry, the Ford, which has been at sea now for many, many months, is starting to experience more and more maintenance problems. There were the well-known problems that it experienced when it arrived in the Mediterranean. The fact that the sewage systems in the ship apparently broke down, but apparently there is more and more problems of wear and tear on the carrier, which are escalating with no sign that any other carrier can be deployed to the zone of operations to take on to replace the Ford and take up the slack. So anyway, I mention all of this. You can find all kinds of reports about this sort of thing in all sorts of places. Again, I am not an expert on US naval operations, but I record that which I see. The attacks so far appear to be mostly by ground-based aircraft, and it does appear that the radar systems, the ground-based radars across the Middle East, have suffered massive damage. Another report which I saw, which is in the which I read in the American Conservative, which is a very reliable media outlet on these matters, is that the total cost of this operation for the US military up to this point has been $5 billion. $5 billion over 5 days. The United States, in other words, is spending $1 billion a day on this operation. Now, the United States can afford to spend $5 billion on an operation, on a military operation. But this is a spend over just 5 days. If, as reports yesterday were saying, the United States now is thinking of a 100-day operation, that is a spend of $100 billion on the assumption that the cost continues at $1 billion a day. And $100 billion is going to start to have an effect even on a defense budget as bloated as the defense budget of the United States already is. Already there's reports that the administration is being forced to consider a further request for funding from Congress. As I discussed in my program yesterday, the resolution that was put together in Congress to block the continuation of this operation against Iran failed in the Senate, but it failed on strictly party lines. The same was true in the House. The Democrats voted almost entirely in support of this operation. Republicans opposed it, but then again, there are known to be growing doubts amongst many Republicans about the wisdom of this operation altogether. And there are growing concerns, or one must assume there are growing concerns, about pressing on with an operation of this kind against the weight of public opinion in the United States, which all of the reliable opinion polls in the United States show the American people by a ratio of around 3-1 appear to oppose. Now, there was on this point an article in the London Times by a commentator, Gerard Baker, who writes about American affairs, who is very much on the conservative Republican side of the political spectrum in the United States, and who has historically been a strong supporter of President Trump. And he also was talking about the unease and doubts even amongst senior Republicans in Congress. And he also said that normally when the US military goes into battle, there is an almost automatic reaction in the United States amongst the American public, which is to close ranks and to support the military as it conducts whatever military operation it has been instructed by the president to carry out. In this instance, that has not happened. The doubts about this operation remain there. The opposition to this operation remains extremely strong, and that ought to worry the president and his officials, and it definitely worries Republicans in Congress. So if the administration does indeed have to turn up in Congress and demand a further, say, $60 billion to see this operation through, I wonder what the response in Congress is going to be. It is one thing for Republican congressmen and women to reject a resolution which tries to bring a stop to an ongoing military operation, one which has been authorized and ordered by a Republican president. It is a very, very different thing if they have to then authorize money for an operation like that, giving Americans in advance of the midterms a sense that this operation, which most of them opposed, is now going to have to be paid through their tax dollars. So anyway, we will see what happens there. But there are other factors that must be causing growing unease, or should be causing growing unease, in Washington. And by the way, in Israel as well. Yesterday, I discussed at very considerable length the latest plan to increase pressure on the government of Iran using Kurdish militia in Iraq to conduct ground operations against Iran. And we know that the militia leaders, the Kurdish militia leaders, have received telephone calls from no less a person than Trump himself, which incidentally is rather interesting. But anyway, it seems that Trump, in very peremptory language, told them that this was the moment when they should attack Iran and that he promised them air support if they did. Well, it turns out that on Wednesday, one of these militia leaders, perhaps the most important one, Nechirvan Barzani, who is the president of Iraq's Kurdistan region. Anyway, it turns out that on Wednesday, Barzani had a telephone conversation with none other than Abbas Araghchi, the Iranian foreign minister. And over the course of this telephone conversation, apparently Barzani assured Araghchi that the Kurds will not conduct any kind of military operation against Iran. This is how Middle East Monitor reports this. According to the statement that the Iraqis published, Barzani and Araghchi discussed the latest regional developments and stressed the importance of maintaining peace and stability. Both sides reaffirmed the need to ensure border security and prevent any attempts to destabilize the region or further complicate the situation. Barzani emphasized that the Kurdistan region would remain neutral in the current tensions and would not be drawn into military confrontation. And that we have a direct quote, "The Kurdistan region will not be a party to conflicts and will remain a force of peace." And that is supposed to be something that Barzani said to Araghchi. And this follows a cascade of Iranian drone and missile attacks on American and allegedly Israeli bases and installations, including the American consulate in Erbil, in Iraqi Kurdistan. Now, Barzani, even in a region, the Middle East, where duplicity is a game which everybody plays and takes to lengths which, frankly, are almost beyond imagination. Even in a region like that, Barzani is one of the most, shall we say, practitioners of the politics of duplicity. And any assurance that someone like Barzani gives to Araghchi perhaps should not be given excessive weight. It would be entirely in character for Barzani to tell Araghchi, "Well, don't worry, we're going to remain neutral. All these reports that you've been reading that we are joining up with the Americans and the Israelis to attack you, ignore them, forget them. There's absolutely no truth to them." And even as Barzani gives these assurances with a completely straight face and in an entirely sincere voice, his officials are preparing exactly an attack like that. And in fact, I've had many reports for some months now that the United States and Israel have indeed been working on preparing Kurdish militia in Iraqi Kurdistan to conduct attacks of this kind. But there might, against that, be reasons why this widely expected Kurdish invasion of Iran rather, might not take place at all. I read yesterday a very interesting article in the Daily Telegraph. The title of the article is Trump's Plan to Weaponize the Kurds Against Iran and Why It Could Fail. And it says US wants to arm freedom fighters. Bear in mind that the Daily Telegraph is fervidly pro-Israeli, fervidly hostile to Iran, has consistently supported an American military strike on Iran. It has been agitating and demanding it for years. So when it refers to freedom fighters, don't be surprised. US wants to arm freedom fighters for ground invasion, but support from their own people, which is to say the Kurds, seems to be uncertain. That is what the subtitle to this article says. And, well, if you go deeper into this article, this is what it says. Kurdish forces have been trained, equipped, and are battle-hardened. They have also operated as a proxy US ground force with a coalition mounting the ultimately successful campaign against ISIS in Syria. Israel has also spent years cultivating ties with Kurdish groups as part of efforts to reach out to non-Arab actors in the Middle East. But expert estimates put any potential Iranian Kurdish fighting force at a few hundred to 1,500 men at best. And then we have one of these experts who is Burcu Ocelik, who is a member of the Royal United Services Institute, a senior research fellow and leading expert on Kurdish issues at the Royal United Services Institute, and who, from his name, is perhaps either Turkish or maybe conceivably even Kurdish, just to say. And Mr. Ocelik says the personnel numbers of the Iranian regime and its security apparatus would still far outnumber the Kurds. They're far outnumbered. They're outweaponed. It's not feasible. Well, again, through long experience, I've become very wary of these claims. It may be that there are many more Kurdish fighters than this article suggests, but obviously, an invasion force of a couple of hundred men, or even 1,500 men, against a country of 90 million people with territory twice the size of Ukraine and armed forces that number more than 1 million men. Well, that isn't going to have a big effect on the war. And it may be that Barzani knows this, and it may be that Barzani understands perfectly well that sending his militia into Iran would be to send them on a suicide mission. Probably, possibly, he's also been getting advice from others that this would be an extremely bad idea. Barzani is known to have had long-standing relations with the Turkish president, President Erdogan. It may surprise people that a Kurdish leader has good relations with the president of Turkey, but this has well long been known. And again, to repeat, this is the Middle East where things like that happen all the time. Erdogan, as this Daily Telegraph article also says, is guaranteed to be strongly opposed to any Kurdish military operation in Iranian Kurdistan, which might significantly increase the size of the Kurdish autonomous region in Iraq and might start to make it appear like the core area of a potential independent Kurdistan. Any Turkish leader would regard that as an existential issue and is guaranteed to oppose it. So it is not impossible that Erdogan has been telling Barzani, don't even think about this. And it is also possible that the Iraqi government in Baghdad, which is also under immense pressure, is also telling Barzani the same thing. And of course, the other big party that might be giving warnings to the Kurds is Russia, which has had long-standing connections to various Kurdish groups, and which has in the past provided them with help. And I can't imagine that the Russians would support an operation of this kind. And they might be telling the Kurds, under no circumstances do this thing. And if you even think of doing it, you're going to run up against opposition from us. And as you know, we are indeed a great power and we can make your life very uncomfortable in the future. Now, in my opinion, 1,500 men by themselves would not be enough. Let's assume it is 1,500 men. Would not be enough, obviously, to even dent Iran's defences. Ultimately, however, it comes back to the perennial question of the internal stability of Iran. 1,500 men launched against an Iran that is stable, that has secure command of its armed forces, an Iran whose armed forces continue to accept orders from the central government, armed forces that are willing to continue to fight on behalf of that central government. Well, an Iran like that cannot be unduly alarmed by an incursion, even of a force of 1,500 men. But of course, if Iran is unstable, if there are fractures within Iran's armed forces, if there are people in Iran who are considering defecting, if military units in Iran defect, then of course it's a completely different situation, a completely different picture. In 2024, the reason the Assad government in Syria collapsed was not because Jalani commanded a vast force capable of advancing all the way to Damascus. In fact, the militia that Jalani commanded and which advanced on Aleppo from the jihadi-controlled region of Idlib, that force was actually very small. I'm told that it was less than 1,000 men, 1,000 fighters in total. The reason that invasion succeeded was because the Syrian army collapsed. There was mass defections, soldiers deserted, officers refused to fulfill orders to defend the government, the central government in Damascus. And President Assad himself showed an astonishing passivity in the face of the crisis that was playing out. Now, if something like that were to happen in Iran, then even a few hundred committed disciplined fighters might provoke a major crisis in Iran, which could conceivably lead to a collapse of the government there. So it all in the end comes back to the question of the internal stability of Iran. And for the moment, I have to say that the government in Iran continues to give every appearance of holding together, of being stable, of the armed forces, the IRGC, and the conventional military, the military responsible to the defense ministry, that they continue to fulfill the instructions of the central government, and they're continuing to carry out those instructions effectively and loyally. And, well, there was a program published on CNN. I haven't watched it myself, but I gather that CNN correspondents have been in Iran, I presume mostly Tehran. They appear to report stability, a sense of life carrying on despite the bombing, carrying on as normal, of Iranians talking about their support for their country at this time of crisis, about the shops and the businesses continuing to function, about sufficient food supplies being provided to the population. Now, the last, by the way, is crucial. If supplies of food in Iran are interrupted, if there is a sense that the civilian economy is starting to break down, then we might start to see a major shift in sentiment. But for the moment, that does not appear to be the case. And here again, we come back to Russia and China. Now, Iran is a huge country. It is agriculturally rich. I believe that in normal situations, it is self-sufficient in food. I understand that Iran can mostly feed itself. But of course, Iran is at war, and it might be much more difficult in those kind of conditions to move food and supplies across the country and to keep the civilian population provided for up to the level that is needed to sustain the economy and the political system. However, to repeat a point which I've made many times, Iran is a member of BRICS. The two major BRICS powers, China and Russia, have made clear their support for Iran. Putting aside the question of what military support they may be providing Iran, I suspect that if they are indeed supporting Iran, the provision of economic assistance is probably at least as important, possibly even more important. Now, Iran has been, over the last few years, gradually been building up economic connections to Russia. I've been reading about all of this in the Iranian media. It has been a slow and not always smooth process, but it has been happening. And there are now the first transportation links between Iran and Russia, that they are still very underdeveloped. And one of the things I noticed started to happen last year is that Russia started to supply natural gas to Iran, and perhaps oil as well. Now, that may seem very strange, given that Iran is an oil and gas producer and exporter, it puzzled me as well. But perhaps, and looking back, the decision by Russia and Iran for Russia to supply oil and gas to Iran was already preparation, economic preparation, in advance of the conflict that we are now seeing. Anyway, that's the situation on the Iranian side. Now, of course, the Americans, President Trump, Pete Hegseth, continue to speak in grandiose terms. President Trump, for example, says that the next supreme leader of Iran should be chosen by himself. He continues to speak grandly about the imminent fall of Cuba, which, by the way, is not impossible. He talks about the need to settle the conflict in Ukraine, why he thinks that the Russians at the moment are at all interested in his opinions about this matter. At the present time, I really don't know. But he talks grandly about all of these things. Pete Hegseth continues to talk about everything going incredibly well. He's brushing off, I notice, all criticisms of the way in which operations so far have been conducted. These two, Hegseth and Trump, continue to give a massively optimistic perspective on the conduct of the war. I noticed, by the way, that there seems to be very, very little concern in the United States about the recent destruction of the Iranian frigate off the coast of Sri Lanka. One effect of that sinking, by the way, is that it has caused a collapse in the formerly very good relations between Iran and India. The Iranians feel deeply betrayed by Prime Minister Modi, and Modi's failure to criticize the sinking of this ship after it placed itself in danger by agreeing to attend a military exercise with India at India's invitation. But anyway, put all that aside, which may have implications for the future. I've been checking the situation, the position with the sinking, the legal position with the sinking of this warship. And I read, interestingly, this, and it's in Article 18 of the Second Geneva Convention for the Amelioration of the Condition of Wounded, Sick and Shipwrecked Members of Armed Forces at Sea. That Second Geneva Convention was adopted in 1949. It was ratified by the US Senate in 1955. So it is an international treaty of which the United States is a party under which the US military are bound. And it reads in part as follows: after each engagement, parties to the conflict shall, without delay, take all possible measures to search for and collect the shipwrecked, wounded and sick, to protect them against pillage and ill treatment, to ensure their adequate care, and to search for the dead and prevent their being despoiled. Well, I am not aware of the US Navy taking any step at all with respect to the survivors of this attack on this warship at all. Putting aside whether the attack itself was right or wrong, for the record, I think it was probably wrong. The failure to make any attempt to save survivors is clearly a violation of the Second Geneva Protocol, and I would have thought a war crime. That's my view. Anyway, Pete Hegseth doesn't seem to be at all bothered about that. But I suspect that one thing that is going to cause concern before very long is the deteriorating situation in the Gulf states. I've been reading over throughout the British media, mostly it must be said in the Financial Times, that not only are the Gulf states starting to run out of air defence missile interceptors and are beginning to become very frightened and concerned about this, even as Iranian drones continue to strike at many of their facilities, including their glittering cities, but that there are now reports that supplies of fresh food are starting to run out. And, well, today in the Financial Times, the lead story for in the Financial Times is this. Qatar warns war will force Gulf to stop energy exports within days. And then we go on to read, Qatar's energy minister has warned that war in the Middle East could bring down the economies of the world, predicting that all Gulf energy exporters would shut down production within days and drive oil to $150 a barrel. Saeed Al-Kaabi told the Financial Times that even if the war ended immediately, it would take Qatar weeks to months to return to a normal cycle of deliveries following an Iranian drone strike at its largest liquefied natural gas plant. Qatar, the world's second largest producer of LNG, was forced to declare force majeure this week after the strike at its Ras Laffan plant. While Qatar only exports a small portion of its gas to Europe, the energy minister said the continent would feel significant pain as Asian buyers outbid Europeans for whatever gas is available on the market, as other Gulf countries find themselves unable to meet their contractual obligations. Everybody that has not called for force majeure, we expect will do so in the next few days that this continues. All exporters in the Gulf region will have to call force majeure. If they don't, they're at some point going to pay the liability for that legally, and that's their choice. In other words, if they can't supply gas or oil and they don't invoke force majeure, then they are liable to their customers for their failure to honour their contracts, which almost inevitably is going to oblige them to invoke force majeure. And then the Financial Times goes on to say, Kaabi's comments reflect rising concern in the Gulf about the economic repercussions of the US and Israel's war with Iran, which has wreaked havoc across the oil-rich region. Brent crude rose 2.5% to $87.6 a barrel on Friday in morning in Europe, that following the publication of this article, the highest level since the start of the conflict. European gas prices gained 5%, but were still below this week's peak. And then we go on to read that Al-Kaabi says that this will bring down the economies of the world. If this war continues for a few weeks, GDP growth around the world will be impacted. Everybody's energy price is going to go higher. There will be shortages of some products and there will be chain reaction of factories that cannot supply. And he says that while there's been no damage so far to Qatar's offshore operations, aftermath onshore was still being reviewed. So $150 a barrel within a short time, within a few weeks. Some say as little as 1 week. And Already oil prices continue to rise. And of course, we've seen that the reports suggest that far from the US military rushing to escort ships through the Straits of Hormuz, the US Navy appears to be, based on more reports, putting more, not less, of a distance between itself and Iran. Well, I don't know how long this can continue for. So far, Iran, as I said, continues to be stable. Iran appears to be now using more advanced missiles. At least that's what they're saying. There's said to be more impacts on Israel itself. It's very difficult to judge the situation in Israel because, as was the case during the 12-day war in June last year, the Israelis maintained very tight censorship on Iranian missile impacts on Israeli territory. Just saying. But Iran remains stable. It may be, based on these articles that I've just been reading today, that the Kurdish invasion of Iran is going to prove to be something of a phantom. I'm not saying this definitely, but there are some reports that suggest this. And Barzani's conversation with Araghchi, for what it's worth, might suggest that too. There is this continuing problem of depletion of American weapon systems. There's an article in the British media today which says that not only is Ukraine now going to be very short of missiles of every type, air defense missiles, but air-to-air missiles also, and that the situation with military equipment in Ukraine is becoming critical. But that there are similar problems with Taiwan, that Taiwan's ability to maintain its defense against a possible attack by China is eroding away, and that this is causing growing concern and alarm within the Pentagon on the part of people like Elbridge Colby, for example, just saying. And, well, we also see the rise in oil prices, the problems of depression, the worries about a cost of living crisis returning to the United States if energy prices rise, the possibility that I've discussed in previous programs that the president may have little option in that case but to reduce or stop LNG exports to Europe faced by that kind of crisis, which will put Europe itself in an almost unthinkably dreadful situation. And of course, the further issue that at some point, given the burn rate in terms of costs, the United States, the administration, the Pentagon may have to turn to Congress for a $60 billion, $100 billion appropriation to continue to fund this war against Iran, which there may be difficulties getting Congress to agree to. Well, this is not over by any means. Iran is now in the sixth day since the start of the war. The situation there appears for the moment to be stable, but that is not a guarantee that it will always be so. Sometimes a collapse can happen suddenly, and it may be that something like that happens in Iran. But absent that, if things go on the way they are, and for the moment, I have to say, there is no objective reason why they should not continue the way they are, well, it seems to me that the president and his team have a very, very great deal to worry about. In fact, the word debacle might indeed start to be used. And of course, it would be worse than a debacle. It would be a crisis. One of the most interesting reports that I've seen over the last 24 hours is one which discussed the situation, the mood amongst the leaders of the Gulf states. They are apparently indeed in a panic. And instead of doing what you might expect in this situation, begging the president to call this whole thing off, they are begging the president to escalate and to bring this to the point where Iran is indeed destabilized and the government in Iran is overthrown. And the reason they are apparently saying this is that they fear that if all of this is called off now, Iran is the clear-cut victor. The entire premise of development in the Gulf region, that the Gulf is an oasis of stability in the Middle East because of American protection, will have been completely shot to pieces. That the Gulf states will, in the event of a clear Iranian victory, be exposed to the vengeance of Iran. And this has become for them the greatest single nightmare. They are urging the US to win, not because they are happy that this war was fought, not because they have confidence in what the decisions that the president up to now has made, but because they are becoming increasingly desperate, that they gambled their entire future on an American guarantee, which it seems is not being honoured. That, by the way, given the desperation that we are now seeing amongst the Gulf states, perhaps indicates how critical the situation altogether has become. It is indeed true that if the United States, if the US government does have to call this whole thing off, with the political system in Iran intact and still there, then those Gulf governments are indeed high and dry, caught left high and dry. And I do wonder what, in that case, they're all of them going to do. I would say, though, and perhaps this is worth pointing out, that even as the Gulf states are apparently begging the Americans to escalate, they're simultaneously telling the Russians that they demand that they want to cease a ceasefire. That's what all of the Russian readouts of the conversations between the Gulf states and Putin said. I wonder whether these leaders are now hedging, whether they're saying to themselves, if the Americans can't win this, rather than be left high and dry, let's look to the Russians and the Chinese instead. As I said, this is the Middle East. Duplicity is the name of the game here. It would not be surprising at all if the leaders of the Gulf states are telling the Americans one thing and are telling the Russians something completely different, and are hoping that one way or the other, whatever happens, they will find their way through. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program, discussing the situation in the Middle East. Very difficult situation, continues to be a very difficult situation to read, but certainly the pictures of the destruction of all of those American radar systems, advanced radar systems in the Middle East, which appear to be genuine, which in fact are genuine, not AI fakes. Those have certainly had an effect on me, and they do reinforce my sense that this whole operation is not going well at all. Now, since I've talked about AI fakes of satellite photos, before I turn quickly to the situation in Ukraine, which I'm going to discuss very shortly, in very short order, I just wanted to say one thing, which is that a couple of programs ago, I discussed a satellite picture of what was alleged to be the aftermath of a Ukrainian missile strike on the gigantic Votkinsk factory where Russia builds a lot of its missiles. And there was a picture of a warehouse with what looked like a big hole in the roof, and it was suggested that this was the effect of the impact of a Ukrainian Flamingo missile. I'm now wondering whether this satellite photo was actually a fake. Just saying. I remember that I did wonder a bit how it could be that if a Flamingo missile really did penetrate through the roof of this warehouse and create an explosion, how there was any part of the roof still there, even allowing for the enormous strength and durability of factory buildings in the former Soviet Union. But bear in mind, the Flamingo missile is supposed to carry a warhead with around a ton of explosive. And assuming that we're talking about rockets and rocket engines and high fuels and rocket fuels, one would imagine an enormous explosion that might have destroyed the entire structure. Instead, as I said, just a picture of a single hole. I don't know for a fact that that satellite photo was a fake, but I have to say, in light of what I've been reading about the way in which satellite photos are being faked, I'm starting to lean towards that possibility. Bear in mind, I'm not, anyway, because of vision issues, a person to be able to make sense very well of satellite photos anyway. Well, in the meantime, the war in Ukraine continues. The Russians continue to capture more territory. They've captured some further settlements close to the town of Stepnogorsk and Liman in northern Donbass. And they have also made further advances in Zaporozhye region towards Orekhov. And the reports that they have captured the village of Grishino, northwest of Pokrovsk, do appear to be true, though this has not yet been confirmed by the Russian Defense Ministry. I expect it will be at some point over the next couple of days. There's been much expectation of another big Russian drone and missile strike. The fact that it hasn't yet taken place has led to some discussion. the Ukrainians tried to carry out a big drone attack on Western Russia a few days ago. Some of these drones supposedly were launched towards the Engels Air Base, and there's been some suggestions that this drone attack might have disrupted the Russian preparations for the drone and missile strike that the Russians are preparing. I strongly doubt that this is the case, by the way. I think that if the Russians have delayed a drone and missile attack, it is more likely to be connected in some way with the situation in the Middle East. I can imagine that the Russians have been undertaking certain redeployments of missile and drone forces. In fact, I've already heard that they have, that they've positioned a Rubicon unit close to the border in the Northern Caucasus, close to Azerbaijan, for example. And it could be that some Russian bomber aircraft have been redeployed to that region as well. I very, very much doubt that Ukrainian drone attacks have made any difference. Once the Russians have completed these redeployments, they will no doubt resume drone and missile strikes on Ukraine in exactly the way that they have been doing previously. As for ground operations, it's worth pointing out that March is the classical period of the spring thaw of the Rasputitsa, the time when the ground turns swampy. And the Rasputitsa this year is likely to be especially long and especially severe in terms of creating mud conditions, because January and February were months of very, very heavy snowfalls. And with the rising temperatures, all of that snow which is on the ground is going to melt. And well, much of Ukraine, including all of these areas where the fighting is taking place, are going to turn into extremely sticky swamp, almost like glue. And that does, of course, have an effect on military operations. For the record, I believe that the major focus at the moment is Konstantinovka. I suspect that significant fighting continues to be taking place there. The fact that we're not getting reports from Konstantinovka is probably a sign that things are actually moving quite rapidly there. But my expectations is that the big movements of forces to happen in April after the Rasputitsa ends, exactly as happened last year and the year before that. Just saying. So anyway, in the meantime, the Russians showing little interest any longer in negotiations. There's no talk of a meeting, a further meeting, a follow-up meeting with between the Russians, the Ukrainians, and the Americans. In fact, there's a lot of commentary that after the extraordinarily duplicitous way, and this is, when I say duplicitous, the Russian government has actually said this duplicitous way in which the negotiations between the United States and Iran were conducted, with the United States using the negotiations to provide cover for its build-up and preparations for the attack on Iran, and again to set up the situation which led to the assassination, the killing of Khamenei and of all of those other top Iranian leaders. Anyway, there seems to be no interest in Russia in resuming those negotiations. And I would add that there is some talk in Russia that Witkoff in particular has been exposed as a duplicitous and treacherous negotiator with whom it would be unwise for Russia to work with in future. Just saying. Anyway, there's no talk of that. There continues to be talk of a major build-up by the Russians. Sirsky, the Ukrainian military chief, says that he expects the size of the Russian force in Ukraine to exceed 800,000 men this year. In other words, for it to increase still further over and above its size last year. And, well, of course, for what it's worth, the Russians are making a huge amount of money from the recent increase in oil and natural gas prices. I've discussed in my previous program how Putin has now said that the time has come to stop immediately all further deliveries of LNG to Europe, that it makes more sense to redirect Russian LNG sales to Asian suppliers, to Asian customers. The Financial Times has now published a whole article about how China is going to have to turn increasingly to Russia for its oil and gas imports. Well, we've been predicting this and talking about this on the Duran for a very, very long time. And India, it turns out, is now also ramping up its purchases of Russian oil. It's apparently told the United States that it has no choice now but to resume imports of Russian oil. Even Trump has had to accept the inevitable logic of all of this. And so India is now importing Russian oil in apparently record quantities because India has no choice to. It seemed for a time that Russia might run a budget deficit this year, as it did last year, though it's important to say that Russia was perfectly capable of covering both deficits. And this would not have been the problem that many people in the West, in the commentariat in the West, seemed to imagine. Well, if this continues for much longer, that deficit this year, because of higher receipts from oil and gas sales, that deficit might become a surplus. I doubt, by the way, that it's going to have any major effect on the economy overall or on the conduct of military operations by the Russians in Ukraine. But what it will do is that it will enable the Russians to replenish their financial reserves, their rainy day reserves, and perhaps to pay off some debt. And anyway, one way or the other, it will put them in a better position going forward. Anyway, there we are. That's the situation today. Some people in the United States talking about a 100-day war. Maybe that is the plan. It seems to me like a very, very bad plan indeed. It seems absolutely clear to me that President Trump and his officials, those who have advocated for this plan, assumed that the killing of Khamenei and the other top leaders of the Iranian leadership would indeed create a power vacuum in Iran, which would lead to the collapse of the government there. They cannot have expected a long war. There is no sign that they planned for a long war. They're caught in a trap of their own devising. They ignored the warnings that many people, including the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the top strategists in the Pentagon and others, not to mention us on the Duran, were warning that, you know, Iran might be a rather more complicated proposition than they assumed. Anyway, they ignored all of those warnings. The president apparently got very angry when he received warnings. In a live stream that we did 2 days ago, Robert Barnes, the US attorney, who's very well informed about the situation in Washington, said that a US Navy admiral who warned the president or tried to warn the president about the perils of this entire operation was simply sacked for his pains. Anyway, they lurched into this thing. And as far as I can see, the only plan now is to keep fingers crossed, wait for the cracks in Iran to appear, hope that something happens with the Kurds, and, well, continue this operation for as long as possible and hope that Iran will break before the United States runs out of missiles and oil and gas prices rise to the sort of levels that will start to impact not just on the global economy, but on American consumers who remain, anyway, deeply critical of the war. What was it Sun Tzu is supposed to have said? That he who knows himself and knows his enemy need not fear the outcome of 100 battles. And he who knows himself but not his enemy will suffer a defeat for every victory that he gains. But that he who knows neither himself nor the enemy will suffer an inevitable defeat and will fail in everything he undertakes. Well, it's perhaps too early to say that we are looking at the last of those three, but as of this morning, it's beginning to look like so. Anyway, this is me for today. There'll be more from me soon. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, and Substack. Please remember that you can support our work by Patreon and Subscribestar and by checking out our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.